It's Tuesday, November 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello, glad you're with us. Coming up, leaders of the United States and Israel meet amid tension and turmoil.
The suspicion that this airport had a situation where a bomb was placed on board the aircraft will, at the very, very least, call into question the security procedures for that airport.
Investigators examine security procedures following a deadly Russian passenger jet crash. Also ahead, technology and law. One of the two is moving much faster. Which direction is a popular singing group going? It's all coming up on today's International Edition. U.S. President Barack Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met in Washington Monday, trying to find ways to cope with what the U.S. leader described as a deteriorating security environment in the Middle East. The two leaders have often had a fractious relationship, and their meeting was the first in more than a year. VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey joins us from the White House to fill us in on how the leaders got along and what they discussed.
We saw Netanyahu come to the United States and speak very vocally and very sharply regarding the Iran nuclear agreement. And that speech that he made before Congress at the invitation of the House Speaker, Republican John Boehner at the time, was seen as an affront and an insult to President Obama as the U.S. Tried to negotiate this Iran nuclear deal. So this is their first meeting in a year, and obviously first since that Iran nuclear agreement was reached. And people were anticipating on how this would go. Obviously, they spoke before they actually went into 2 hours of talks, but just seeing the body language when both of them spoke to the press before going into talks, Obama and Netanyahu looked on earnestly at each other as either of them spoke. They shook hands. They talked a lot about a close alliance and friendship. And just in the body language and the remarks, it was clear that they're both leaders and both countries are trying to move past these recent tensions and this discord and trying to move on to these areas of common ground.
These are two veteran politicians.
Yes.
And obviously they do have some very serious issues at hand that are common to both the United States and Israel. And they were talking about these, such as trying to blunt the activities of certain groups like Islamic State and Hezbollah and other insurgent groups.
Absolutely. And going back to Iran, and President Obama was clear that, you know, he called the disagreement on the nuclear issue, on the nuclear agreement, a, quote, narrow issue. Instead, he said both countries find common ground on Iran's destabilizing activities. Prime Minister Netanyahu mentioned Hezbollah. And they obviously both talked about the deteriorating security situation in the Middle East with the Islamic State militant group in Syria. And both leaders said now more than ever is a time for even closer U.S.-Israeli intelligence and military cooperation because of the need to deter the threat of terrorism. So that was a big area of common ground. What's going on in Iraq? What's going on in Syria and the fight against the Islamic State and other militant groups? And then, of course, there's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with President Obama talking about the need to kind of lower the temperature with we saw this recent tensions, violence, and recent attacks against Israeli citizens. He talked about the need and the right and obligation of Israel to defend itself. But at the same time, he talked about the legitimate aspirations of the Palestinians. Now, President Obama did not name the two-state solution. He didn't say two-state solution, but what was interesting is that the prime minister did. The prime minister said that, you know, I want to be clear, we have not given up our hope for peace. We'll never give up the hope for peace. And Prime Minister Netanyahu says that he remains committed to a vision of peace of two states for two peoples. So that was an interesting comment coming off of what Prime Minister Netanyahu said during his campaign earlier this year. And given what we've seen in terms of actions and settlement activity, so there were some big areas of discussion during their more than 2 hours of talks in the Oval Office today.
Well, Aru Pandey, you are at the White House, and we appreciate your insight for today's meeting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, more than a billion people around the world actively use Facebook on a monthly basis, and that number is continuing to grow. Despite such widespread usage, there's one particular account that opened today that's getting an awful lot of attention. And keeping within that White House theme, we turn to International Edition's G. Abby Lee, who joins me in the studio with some details. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. It's a big deal when the leader of the free world sets up his own Facebook page. U.S. President Barack Obama is now on Facebook at facebook.com/POTUS. That's POTUS. More than 45,000 people liked his page in the first hour it went live.
Did he write anything on this page yet?
He did. There are milestone updates like when he was born, got married, and sworn in as a president twice. But his actual post is about climate change, or what we can do to stop it, rather. So here's what he wrote. Hello, Facebook. I finally got my very own page. I hope you like this. Think of this as a place where we can have real conversations about the most important issues facing our country. Now, somewhere in the second paragraph, he wrote, "We've got to preserve this beautiful planet of ours for our kids and grandkids, and that means taking serious steps to address climate change once and for all. If we're all in this together, I'm confident we can solve this and do right by our future generations." Now, the writing is accompanied by a video clip of Mr. Obama delivering a similar message from his White House lawn.
I'm looking forward to checking out his page, and I can only imagine the amount of attention that his post is getting. What is it like?
Well, a lot of famous people commenting on his first post. So Sheryl Sandberg, who is a chief operating officer of Facebook, wrote the first comment. She wrote, "Welcome to Facebook, President Obama. Excited for you to have your very own page and looking forward to the conversation." About 3,500 people liked that comment. TV anchor Katie Couric also wrote a short and sweet message. She commented, "Welcome to Facebook, President Obama."
Well, gee, how many people like the page so far?
About 250,000 people so far, but we both know that number will increase really quickly.
Well, you and I are going to have to add our comments to the page. Absolutely. Thanks for being here today, G. Our program is also on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA.Asia. And you can always follow us on Twitter, of course, at VOA_IE. G. Abby Lee is there as well on her account at G. Abby Lee. I'm at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. A member of the investigation team has told Reuters the team is 90% sure the noise heard in the final second of a cockpit recording was an explosion caused by a bomb on the ill-fated Metrojet A321 that crashed more than 20 minutes after takeoff on October 31st from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. All 224 people on board perished. The Islamic State affiliate in Egypt has claimed responsibility. Confirmation of that claim could be devastating to Egypt's tourism trade, which already is set back by recent political turmoil. Todd Curtis of the air safety website airsafe.com told VOA's Victor Beatty if a bomb is proven to have brought down the Metrojet flight, the risk level for a similar attempt at numerous airports will have increased.
The suspicion that this airport had a situation where a bomb was placed on board the aircraft will at the very, very least call into question the security procedures for that airport. And in a broader sense, this airport is very representative of most airports around the world. It's not a major international airport like JFK or Heathrow. It is a busy airport, certainly, because it serves a fairly popular tourist destination. Typically, not something that you would associate with a politically or socially motivated bombing event, but apparently this appears to be the case. in which case there would be dozens of airports around the world at minimum that may be at risk for the same sort of violence.
Is this going to lead to a reevaluation of check on baggage or compromised employees or issues like that?
It will depend on whether or not, first, if this is determined to be a bomb, and second, what kind of bomb it was. Now, point of fact, there are weaknesses in the system because the system relies on human beings. You have to have people who are flying and operating the aircraft, people who are on board the aircraft as flight attendants, not to mention mechanics, baggage handlers, airport staff, etc. A whole community of people who are dedicated to keeping aircraft flying, any one of which who have regular, intimate access to the aircraft could, if they wished, put something on board the aircraft in the form of contraband. Now, in the U.S. for decades, there has been a problem which has never been stamped out of people who are putting contraband on aircraft for financial purposes, whether it be drugs, which is the most popular kind of contraband, or money or other kinds of objects. People who are insiders to the system have consistently, at least several times a year, have been caught and prosecuted in the U.S. for putting things on aircraft that shouldn't be there. Certainly, it's not the same motivation as someone who may be doing a bombing for political purposes, but it does show the same kind of weakness. Whatever vetting process exists is not going to be perfect because people have different motivations at different phases of their lives, different phases of their careers. So it stands to reason that if you have tens or even hundreds of thousands of people involved in the aviation system as baggage handlers, as mechanics, etc., some of them, at any given time, will be vulnerable to persuasion or to other coercion to do something they shouldn't do.
With falling oil prices, flights are up. Of course, we have the holiday season coming up. Is the traveling public concerned?
Certainly, the traveling public should be concerned because the expectation when you buy a ticket to go from point A to point B, that you do so in a safe manner and, secondarily, in a timely manner. And if you have a situation where there is a clear violation of that expectation, a clear risk that has to be addressed, then it stands to reason that the average passenger would like to see that addressed, either by an airline, by a government authority, or by some other entity who will either eliminate the risk entirely, reduce the likelihood that risk ever occurs, or, at worst case, if the risk does occur, make sure that it's not as bad as it could have been if you didn't do anything.
Curtis likens the global flying network to the Internet, a highly complex system that requires a lot of people to cooperate. And therein lies, he says, both its strength and its weakness. Technology, of course, is advancing quickly, so fast that laws and regulations are struggling to keep up. Newsweek journalist Kevin Maney joins us to consider if this is bad or possibly good.
It always depends on your point of view. I write about technology companies. So from their point of view, it's actually kind of a good thing because the speed, as you know, we kind of all know, you know, in a gut feeling way, the speed of technology is speeding up and government is more and more tied up and unable to get anything done. And this gap between the two has actually proved quite beneficial to technologies because stuff can get put out there in the public and adopted before government has any chance to do anything to try to rein it in.
Literally, technology is old by the next day, it seems, anymore. And it takes government a while to draft laws and think about things in a perspective, in a regulatory kind of mode. But with technology, what are some of the things that have outstripped the government in terms of enacting laws?
There's a big issue right now in the U.S. about these daily fantasy sports sites. This is a good example. One is called FanDuel and one is called DraftKings. These two entities are exploiting a small loophole in gambling laws to be able to offer these like apps on phones to do fantasy sports. And it's kind of a skill and it's kind of gambling, but these things have just taken off. And there's something like 50 million people using them now. And these two companies together are worth like $2.5 billion. And they have very upstanding investors like KKR and Comcast, Major League Baseball and NBC and the NHL. Now that they've gotten so popular, the governments are worried that these are actually some kind of illegal gambling sites, and in some states and even the federal government is starting to look at them and thinking of, like, do we shut them down? Do we regulate these things? And it's almost too late because there's so many people using them. There's also a lot of value in these companies. What's the government going to do at this particular point in time? And so these things have gotten, you know, just exploded in about a year's time and gotten way out ahead of the laws. And this kind of thing is happening over and over again. I mean, the other issues going on right now are drones, aircraft that are, you know, starting to crowd our skies, and there's no laws governing them whatsoever. And there's so many of them now that the government can't just ban them. It has to somehow accommodate them.
You make the interesting analogy to automobiles and when they first appeared on the scene more than 100 years ago, and the fact that the government had to deal with the reality as opposed to regulating it ahead of time. And this really has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, you know, it's always important to realize that there's nothing new under the sun, and there's really not. And you go back to the 1910s, and within about 6 or 8 years' time, the number of cars on the roads went from about 200,000 to 2.5 million in the U.S. These cars were dangerous, difficult things for cities to deal with. There was no traffic signs. Pedestrians were not used to anything that could move 20 miles per hour down a street. They were getting hit, and, you know, it was kind of all kinds of havoc getting caused. But by the time any local or state or national governments could do anything to regulate these things, the thing that's different now is that the technologies are coming on the scene and taking a hold in the public so much faster, and so many more, one after another, that government as it exists really has no way to keep up with that.
It's a fascinating article, and you can see it for yourself at Newsweek.com. Kevin Maney is the author of The Law Can't Keep Up with Technology, and that's a very good thing. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
Fans of One Direction have just enjoyed a tour, but are now wondering, what's next for the pop group? VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins me to tell us the latest.
Where are the members of One Direction going to go from here?
I might never be knight in shining armor.
Could be in four different directions. I was going to say five different directions, but of course, they're a quartet now. Zayn Malik left earlier in the year. On October 31st, One Direction finished its world tour back home in England in the city of Sheffield.
When I first saw you from across the room, I could tell that you were curious. Oh yeah, girl, I hope you're sure what you're looking for.
Neil Horan went on Twitter. He promised they would be back following a hiatus. We will have to wait and see.
Right, can't wait.
Their fifth album, Made in the AM, drops on November 13th. So that is coming up fast. And, of course, it's going to be releasing on the same day that Justin Bieber is releasing his Promise album. So it's going to be a huge fight for number one to see who prevails. 1D has four more concert dates posted. They're going to have three U.S. radio shows in California and Texas. That happens the first week of December. And then on December 10th, they appear with Hozier in Birmingham, England. Now, they may also appear 3 days later on the season finale of The X Factor. They began as five separate performers on The X Factor back in 2010, but Simon Cowell, being the pop mastermind that he is, saw these lads would work better together than apart, and of course the rest was history.
That's right. Many directions into One Direction.
That's right.
Well, I'm sure that the proceeds from touring might lure them back out, because That's pretty good money.
Forever is a long time. We have seen many boy bands come back together. On the other hand, it could be that one or more members of One Direction turn into breakout solo stars. In that case, it would be pretty difficult to lure them, you know, back into the fold. The other members might want it, but at this point, it's anybody's guess. We'll just have to wait and see how
and
it
plays
out.
We've seen that. We've seen that a few times with groups where they would split apart, do great on their own, and then there was always that talk about, oh, is there a reunion coming?
Yeah, you have Justin Timberlake and Beyonce just as two examples of breakout stars who will probably never get back together with their old groups. Mm-hmm. But then you have groups like New Kids on the Block and the Backstreet Boys, who have reunited and are touring.
Well, we'll see what happens, which direction this will all take. But we know that we can go one direction each week and listen to the Top 20 Countdown with Ray McDonald. Ray's also on Twitter. Hit it, Ray.
Ray on the hits.
Follow him. Thanks so much for dropping by, Ray.
You got it, Jim. Thank you.
You've been listening to International Edition. Our One Direction is always to bring you the latest news and information. You can find us at voanews.com anytime that you'd like. We're also on Twitter. We invite you to follow us. Our handle at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Ida Nutku. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We thank you so much for being with us and invite you back again tomorrow. Have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One thing is for certain. As our collective populations grow, so will our need for energy. And just as surely, as we ramp up energy production wherever possible, we must turn to production that is clean and sustainable. Today's global population is about 7.3 billion people. Of these, millions are underserved, and about 1 billion have no access at all to electricity. So, given that the population will expand to some 9 billion by the year 2050, in order to accommodate the needs of another 3 billion people, our energy output will need to increase by at least 80%. Even in the short term, the numbers are staggering. As Undersecretary for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli, said recently, in just the next 15 years, we can expect the world will add more than 5,500 gigawatts of electricity capacity. This is the equivalent of adding all the power generation that exists in the world today. At the same time, we need to also reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in the energy sector by 60% to 80% to address global climate change. One of the most promising technological advances in energy production is distributed energy systems, including off-grid solutions, such as power generators and solar panels, said Undersecretary Novelli. And because low-carbon technologies, such as solar panels, will be easier to acquire and cheaper to run than fossil fuel technologies, she said, the vast majority of those new connections will come from renewable energy sources. The United States has recently committed to providing access to off-grid clean energy products and services to more than 500 million people by 2020. This includes a $75 million loan guarantee from USAID's Power Africa program to scale up off-grid renewable investments in sub-Saharan Africa, $20 million in loans from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation for supporting residential solar in Kenya and Nigeria, and $46 million from the Millennial Challenge Corporation for off-grid electrification in Benin. When it comes to energy, our goal is to ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, clean energy for all by 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.